This is Rabbi Josh Yoder of the Stanton Street Shul. Thank you for downloading this class podcast. These classes are provided free of charge through the generosity of the Stanton Street Shul community and supporters like you. If you do enjoy them, please consider making a donation to our synagogue's building fund on our website's shop donate page at www.stantonstshul.com.
Good morning, everyone. It is Sunday, December 23rd, 2012, Fast of Asara Batevet, so hopefully my mouth won't get too dry today because I can't have my morning tea. And today we're moving on to the Rambam's introduction to the Mishneh Torah as part of our series on the halachic process. Where we last left off, just to summarize everything we did from, you know, until now, we set up, you know, the premise that the Torah represents divine will. We went through the rabbinic, descriptions of the halachic process, including whence do you derive rabbinic authority. We described how rabbis themselves, even though they, you know, attributed certain authority, it wasn't self-attributed. They traced it back somehow to the giving of the Torah at Har Sinai, or content of the Torah, depending on whether it's transmission or a legal classification, where God says, if you have any questions, you know, go ask the, priest of the Shofet, like in the Asher B'Yamim Ahim, and the Makom Asher Yivchar. And then they extended, well, now that we have, like, you know, there was a certain area of rabbinic authority, how did that develop to, you know, portray down the line in terms of rabbinic legislation. We went through some of the parameters of rabbinic legislation, some tendencies there in terms of stringencies, in terms of halacha ve'ein morin kein, a distinction between what is official law, what are things, how do you, you could have the laws on the books, and then how do you disseminate that law to the masses. And last week we covered the question of customs and popular practice and what role that plays in the Jewish legal system. You may wonder why we're skipping a few hundred years in Jewish chronology, because halacha didn't, you know, just disappear for a while until Rambam came up. You had, you know, for a few centuries, the Gaonim, who continued with their own series of halachic rulings. And I'm skipping them because I'm not quite sure how to teach it in this context, because to my knowledge, no one actually laid out an explicit statement of here's how halacha works, as more as continued in their own methodology. So in order for us to do that, like, we could do, you know, the She'iltot of Rav Acha Gaon, but it'll be somewhat difficult to get, you know, we would have to go through a whole bunch of halachot there and explain every single thing in detail, and only after we go all through everything can we then sort of reconstruct, well, how does he actually operate? If I do it myself and I try to present it, you'll all have a bunch of really great questions that could only possibly be answered if you study the whole thing. Conveniently enough, Rambam actually lays everything out for you. And for my money, this is one of the most important treatises in Jewish law, because as part of the introduction to the Mishneh Torah, Rambam in fact tells you, here's how halacha works, or at least in his mind how halacha works. And as we go through it, we can try to compare, well, how much does this sync up with what we saw in the Gemara? In terms of the statements that we saw in, of the Gemara defining its own halachic system, right? Because now, I mean, one of the things that we'll try to uncover here that, you know, we started asking, or at least that we began the discussion with rabbinic halacha, is why should we, take the rabbi seriously? And Rambam here is going to explain, well, why should you take Rambam seriously? And we'll see how he does that, all right? And what he constructs here, for those who are into, like, modernism or postmodernism, is, you know, not just a legal system of halacha, but it's sort of described in a type of narrative. And we'll see how all that plays out both factually and perhaps, you know, there could be another message behind how he's trying to tell you how things work. All right? So, Ed, could you start us off? This is from the Eliyahu Tuger translation of Rambam's Mishneh Torah, published by Mosdayim Press. I think it's a very good translation in terms of getting, you know, not just accuracy of the words, but it's very readable. So instead of, you know, just copying and pasting it myself, I figured copies would make things just easier.
So, Rambam's introduction to the Mishneh Torah, preface. In the name of God, Lord of the world, Genesis 21:33. Then I shall not be ashamed when I gaze at all your mitzvot, Psalms 119:6. the mitzvot.
Right. So even before you get here, I mean, there's the advantage with also copying it this way is you get his footnotes. If you see where it says footnote 3 on page 13, does the Rambam introduces every one of the books of the Mishneh Torah by quoting an appropriate verse from the Bible? It is possible to explain that he chose the verse for introduction to the entire text in reply to objections he knew would arise to the Mishneh Torah. The Rambam's conception of his work as a compilation of the entire law would not be acceptable to many. Therefore, he begins by emphasizing that his actions were not presumptuous. There's no need for him to be, quote, ashamed at taking such a step, since he can, quote, gaze at all your mitzvot, i.e., he has knowledge of the entire law, oral law. He is obligated to communicate that knowledge to others, as he explains in Hilchot Talmud Torah later. So according to at least Tuger's explanation here, you know, to introduce by saying, by talking about not being ashamed, you know, with all the mitzvot, he's trying to say, well, it's not a matter of you know, a certain ego, but it's v'abita el kol mitzvotecha. What Rambam does in the Mishneh Torah, I mean, I'm not sure if the psychological thing is necessary, but certainly what he does in the Mishneh Torah is he goes through the entire Torah. He, you know, has the 613 mitzvot that he enumerates. And in a nutshell, well, not really a nutshell, in 14 volumes, and he's going to explain that his intention is to make the entire law accessible to everyone, which, you know, was really unprecedented at that time. And even today, not everyone knows every little part of the law. So it's certainly easy for people to say, well, you know, certain things don't make sense, or this seems out of whack. Whereas before you can start making those judgments, you need to have an understanding of the whole, because there are a lot of moving parts. You know, you could look at any piece of legislation, say even, you know, that comes out of Congress, and you say, wow, that's a really stupid piece of legislation. But when you look at, say, every other law that's on the books, there could be one line in there that's put in to account for a certain condition that was already established in a law that was written 12 years ago. And having that, you know, broad scheme of knowledge, you can still agree with it or not disagree with it, but you'll at least understand what does everything have to do in terms of, you know, how does everything work together as a cohesive whole. So, continue.
The mitzvot given to Moses at Mount Sinai were all given together with their explanations, as is implied. Implied by Exodus. And I will give you the tablets of stone, the Torah, and the mitzvah. The Torah refers to the written law. The mitzvah to its explanation. God commanded us to fulfill the Torah according to the instructions of the mitzvah. The mitzvah is called the oral law.
All right, so there's a so he's making it, saying you've got this pasuk about, you know, you've got Torah and you have mitzvah, whereas Torah, all right, the mitzvah is what we call Torah Sheba'al Peh. Mm-hmm. All right?
Moses, our teacher, personally transcribed the entire Torah before he died. He gave a Torah scroll to each tribe and placed another scroll in the ark as a testimonial.
Yeah. Stop for there for a second. Yeah.
Both of these quotes, I mean, you can translate and interpret them any way you want.
Mm-hmm.
Surely he's using them only to back up some historical statements that he believes.
Yes. The truth is, it could also be that he's quoting a Gemara. Let me see if he has the footnote here. No, he doesn't have the quote here. It's quite possible for the don't know exactly where this particular derasha was is made in Chazal. It could very well be that there's some derasha in the Midrash that uses this analogy as well, in which case it's not just him coming up with it on his own as much as citing an earlier teaching. But honestly, I'd have to check that out. But it's possible. And are you arguing that what he's doing is kind of self-serving in this way?
Well, yeah. I mean, I'm asking him, how do you know that all the explanations were given? And he quotes this verse? Come on.
Well, you'd have to... Okay, we only got through like a couple of paragraphs here. So following the Rambam's line of like, you have to go, or at least the pasuk of, you know, v'bitel kol mitzvotecha, you have to, you know all the mitzvot. You have to go through the entire thing here in terms of, you know, what exactly is it based on.
That's a way of shutting them up.
It's not a way of shutting them up as much as, you know, you can't read the first two paragraphs of War and Peace and say, well, what happens at the end? Like, how does this all work together? Sometimes you have to finish the book to understand what's going on.
Yeah, but
now, if you're stopping at just this point, now, you could be right, right? And in the sense that he's trying to get to a certain point. Maybe, right? In which case, we would have to figure out how much of his core argument is really dependent on a derasha versus how much of it is going to be rhetoric. When I go up and give a drasha, when any rabbi goes up and gives a drasha, right, you've got an ultimate point the rabbi is getting at, and then there's usually some textual basis for it. Now, one doesn't necessarily lead to the other. Some rabbis do a better job of this than others in terms of does the way that you quote or the way that you use the text actually have bearing on your ultimate point. Right? Now, maybe it does, maybe it doesn't, depending on how well you know the grammar, but that might not necessarily matter. Meaning, if I can give a logical reason for like why my opinion might be correct, the fact that I can cite a verse that may or may not support it could be ancillary. Right? So the fact that Rambam is describing the Torah and mitzvah differently, if one referring to the, this is how one refers to what came from God and the other refers to the oral law, was that true, was that not true historically? Let's say you want to argue that. The other question would be, let's say, yeah, even if it is disputable, what bearing would that have on the Rambam's ultimate point? Is that derasha necessary for everything the Rambam says later on to make sense?
I'm not interested in the drasha as much as I'm interested in his assertion of historical fact.
And I would counter that, what would that necessarily matter? He's going to make a few other assertions of historical fact that may or may not necessarily be accurate from a matter of history, but are communicating a different sort of ethos, perhaps, or at least my own drasha when we get to it. So could it be historical fact? Let's say maybe, maybe not. But the second question has to be, what difference would that make?
It would affect how much I'm willing to accept of all these laws.
Fair enough. But, all right, so let's table that for a moment in terms of willingness to accept.
I mean, in other words, are they man-made or God-given? And he asserts they're God-given. How do I know he's right?
That goes back to the very, week number one or two.
How does he know he's right?
Well, so we'll get
That's
there as well.
Well, basic.
He's going to address that, too, in terms of why we... When we get to the end, we will have an answer to the question of why should we take Rambam seriously?
Also, this thing, Moses, our teacher, that always annoys me. Moshe Rabbeinu. He's not my teacher. I never saw the guy. I don't even know if he existed. And I'm supposed to say he's my teacher?
Right. So this goes back to the second week in terms of, the first premise that we have whenever we discuss halacha is that the Torah is representative of divine will in some way. Right? Because if you don't believe that the Torah is representative of divine will, then yes, absolutely nothing else matters. Right? It is a premise that really, if I cannot convince anyone that God exists, let alone that God gave the Torah. And we showed how you can't use the Torah to prove itself, meaning you can't say, well, clearly God gave the Torah because the Torah says so. Right, and that's where I gave the Harry Potter analogy. It'd be like saying that, well, Hogwarts must exist because it says so in the book, Harry Potter. Hogwarts exists, therefore it's true. Right? It has to be an assumption that the Torah does represent divine will, and because all of what we know about God comes from the book of the Torah. There are a lot of other people in the world who aren't Jewish who still believe in God, yet believe in a very different conception of God. So yes, we are still continuing with that core premise of the Torah representing divine will. Once you have that assumption, calling Moshe Rabbeinu makes a great deal of sense here. Now you could still argue, that just because you know that the Torah represents divine will, that this distinction, or at least this Rambam's way of meaning Torah and Mitzvah, may not be entirely accurate. But we also went through the Gemara in terms of what is the basis for oral law. So Rambam at this point is continuing with an assumption, not only that the Torah represents divine will, God made these commandments, but also that you have an oral tradition that went along with it, that was since expounded upon by the rabbis, that he is going to elaborate exactly what that means.
So that's number two in a list of axioms.
About the oral law? Well, yes, because that we dealt with the very beginning of Rabbinic Judaism. Meaning, yes, an assumption that Rambam is making is that all that stuff in the Talmud is in fact legitimate. Or at least, if not every statement in the Talmud being legitimate, the assumption of an oral law being legitimate. Yes, that is an assumption that Rambam is making. All right, now again, can we prove it? Hard to do. Chazal tried to justify their own authority, but you could just easily disregard it. Well, I don't believe you, or there were too many flaws for us to take you seriously. Yes, you could in fact critique Chazal on those points. For Rambam, right, you don't. right? You're assuming that there was, in fact, an oral tradition, and he's going to explain just how this oral tradition, you know, worked and developed. All right, Shalamis, can you take up the next paragraph with the mitzvah? Yeah, we don't have official headings here, so.
The mitzvah, the explanation of the Torah, he did not transcribe. Instead, he commanded it verbally to the elders, to Joshua, and to the totality of Israel. As in Deuteronomy states, be careful to observe everything that I have prescribed to you. For this reason, it is called the oral law.
Right, so here he's justifying, like you can argue, well, we can interpret this verse any way you want, but he says, et kol hadavar, asher nochim mitzvah etchem oto, tishmeru la'asot. Rama's saying this is something that was, you know, this for this reason, it's the oral law, because it was commanded, like orally, to the Jewish people to do. Right? And you have enough statements about the Torah being taught publicly and commanded to the entire Jewish people. Continue.
Even though the oral law was not transcribed, Moses, our teacher, taught it in its entirety in his court to the 70 elders. Eleazar, Pinchas, and Yeshua received the tradition from Moses. In particular, Moses transmitted the oral law to Joshua, who was his primary disciple, and instructed him regarding it.
Mm-hmm.
Similarly, throughout his life, Joshua taught the oral law. Many elders received the tradition from him. Eli received the tradition from the elders and from Pinchas. Samuel received the tradition from Eli and his court. David received the tradition from Samuel and his court.
All right, Dan, take the next paragraph.
Ahia of Shiloh was one of those who experienced the Exodus from Egypt. He was a Levite and heard teachings from Moses. He was, however, of low stature in Moses' age. Afterwards, he received the tradition from David and his court. Elijah received the tradition from Ahijah of Shiloh and his court. Elisha received the tradition from Elijah and his court. Jehoiada the priest received the tradition from Elisha and
right,
his
actually,
court.
Stop there for a second. So you'll notice that you've got, after Ahijah of Shiloh, with the footnote number 10 to Gemara and Bava Batra 121b, now, you'll notice that that paragraph, to me, is really crucial, bringing in Achia Shiloni. Anyone understand why? Why is that an anomaly?
Never heard of him.
Well, you never heard of him. That's a great one. Yeah.
No, I mean, my tendency is to say, you know, you claim that everything you're saying was dictated to Moses.
Yeah.
And yet, I mean, we've got a couple of hundred years where we have people we never heard of, and how do we know?
Well, in fairness, right? I mean, you've got Eli.
Yeah, but that's what I'm saying.
Eli's mentioned.
So they're bringing this.
Pinchas is mentioned,
to avoid
right?
That argument.
Shmuel is mentioned,
right,
and Shmuel
right,
to David.
Right.
That's fine.
Yeah, but this game of telephone,
well,
you pass it on to it keeps getting distorted.
Hold on. Well, we don't know about distortions. Before you get to distortions, what's the deal with Ahijah of Shiloh? Anyone see an obvious problem with this guy? Aside from not knowing who he is, because he's not as well known. Yeah? Anyone see an obvious logical problem here?
He's very long-lived.
Yes! He is incredibly long-lived. Not only is he long-lived, but who should have come after David?
Shlomo.
You'd think Shlomo, yeah. Right? Solomon took over after David, and instead of going after, you know, saying, oh, David to Solomon, and going in a straight chronological order, we skip Solomon, and we go back in time several hundred years to this guy, Ahijah of Shiloh, right? According to this, Ahijah of Shiloh is one of those who experienced the Exodus from Egypt, right? Which meant, if he actually left Egypt, so he survived the 40 years in the desert and still made his way through. So even that's... again, following Ramos, if he experienced the Exodus, right? So maybe he was under the age of, you know, 20 at the time, right? So he was a young kid at the time of, so he was 40 by the time he entered the land of Israel in the time of Joshua. He lived through the entire reign of Joshua, right? The entire reign of all of the judges, right? You're talking about several hundred years here winding up there, right?
Isn't there a contradiction that the Jews in the desert were all killed off?
Only from a certain age up.
Oh.
Meaning, because it wasn't the entire Jews. If he was, say, under the age of 20, right, he would say, you know, then he would have made it all the way through. He just would have been 40 by the time he entered the land of Israel.
Mm.
So this seems to be a bit of a stretch, don't you think?
Yes.
Yes. My opinion, and I stress this is only mine, I don't know if anyone else has written on this, is that there was an intentional reason why he skipped Shlomo HaMelech. That's kind of midrashic. You know why?
Well, I could see, I mean, Shlomo It's like he's not a divine personality. He's very earthy.
He built a Beit HaMikdash. You could say that's pretty earthy because you're like building a huge thing.
He had a dream where God gave him ego.
But God gave him divine wisdom, right? If you take everything seriously. That's not just an earthy thing. Yeah. My interpretation, and I confess, this is only an interpretation in terms of why Rambam would do this, in that according to Midrashim, what Shlomo sinned in his life was by putting himself above the law. How so? The Torah gives two particular commandments to kings, and for each one of them, the Torah gives a reason why a king, you know, why this shouldn't happen. One, king shouldn't have too many horses, lest he go down to Egypt, and a king shouldn't have too many wives, lest, you know, they lead him astray. According to Pshat in the Navi, according to the literal text, he had quite a few horses, and he did, in fact, go down to Egypt. He had too many wives, and according to literal text, he did a Avodah Zarah. Yes, I know the Gemara gives a bit of a whitewash over that, but fine. According to Pshat in the text, that's what he did. And my guess is that since it's ascribed to, you know, David HaMelech, right, according to, again, Pshat in the Navi, sinned with Bathsheba. But when he was caught on it, he said, Chatati Lashem, I sinned before God. He wrote his a specific mizmor, chapter of Tehillim, regarding the affair with Bathsheba, where he mentions in, I think, four different ways how bad he sinned, like Chatati, Pashati, a few other terms, right? One thing, if you get caught, you don't expect leaders to be perfect, because everyone's going to sin, right? But David, when you get caught, admits, okay, yeah, I sinned. That, at least, you're acknowledging that there is a law to which you're going to be held accountable. Whereas when you say, well, there's a reason for a law, this law doesn't apply to me, and therefore I can do what I want, even though the actual, what you're doing might be of less significance as, say, you know, having an affair with a woman and sending her husband out to the front lines so that he should die, makes you an antinomian. It places you above the law. It's a way of saying, yes, this is a law in the books, but because I know the reason, the law doesn't apply to me. And it's a guess, based on that midrashic interpretation that I have, of why Rambam would sort of, you know, do what we'd say historical. I mean, I would call this more of a mythic history type thing. I don't know if this is actually historically accurate, but why he would take an approach of, you know, putting Achi of Shiloh, even though it seems logically, you know, harder to grasp, specifically to substitute for Shlomo, because with Shlomo, he went, you know, by placing himself above the law, would not have been as meritorious to be the real transmitter of law, and in which case, by throwing in Achi of Shiloh, you sort of reset things. Mm-hmm. Now, is this true? I have no idea. This is my interpretation of the Rambam.
Did you read Bava Batra, and is it based on that?
Not exactly. Mm-hmm. But, yeah, this is just, it's a way of trying to explain it, otherwise, don't know what to tell you of, like, why he skips over Shlomo.
Is this a totally made-up name?
No. I don't think so. No.
I mean, does it appear in the...
So, for context, since people have been asking about Achia, mentioned in Melachim Aleph, Kings 1, Chapter 11, and begins by saying, V'amelech Shlomo ahav nashim nochriyot rabot, et bat paro moaviyot amoniyot admoniyot siniyot chitiyot. Solomon loved many foreign women in addition to Pharaoh's daughter, Moabite, Ammonite, Edomite, Phoenician, and Hittite women, from the nation of which the Lord had said to the Israelites, none of you shall join them, and none of them shall join you, lest they turn your heart away to follow their gods. Such Solomon clung to and loved. He had 700 royal wives and 300 concubines, and his wives turned his heart away. In his old days, his wives turned away Solomon's heart after other gods.
How can anybody read Shlomo's mind and say he turned his heart toward other gods?
Well,
maybe he was just checking out the scene. He was curious. He wanted to visit the
Again, we're assuming that this ritual. We're going to again assume that this is written with some degree of prophecy here, in which case we'll grant them a certain license.
Giving them a little slack.
Continues here. Vayashlomo harabene Hashem velomileach Hashem kedavid aviv. Solomon did what was displeasing to the Lord and did not remain loyal to the Lord like his father David. He built a shrine for Chemosh, the abomination of Moab. Yeah, a bunch of other stuff. Lord was angry. A bunch of other, you know, statements about God being upset, bringing up
bringing up other enemies. And here we have, in verse 29, V'be'itahi yovi yaravim yitzem yushalayim yimtze oto ach yashilo niha navi b'darf umikaseh. During that time, Yeravam went out of Jerusalem, and the prophet Ahiah of Shiloh met him on the way. He had put on a new robe. The two were alone in the open country. Ahiah took hold of the new robe he was wearing and tore it into 12 pieces. Take 10 pieces, he said to Yeravam, for thus said the Lord God of Israel, I am about to tear the kingdom out of Solomon's hands, and I will give you 10 tribes. But one tribe shall remain for his, for the sake of my servant David, and for the sake of Jerusalem, the city I have chosen out of all the tribes of Israel. Stop. So, remember what I said before. Based on this particular verse where Ahiah of Shiloh is actually mentioned, it would seem to be in direct response to Shlomo taking too many wives, turning away from God, that, all right, Shlomo is not going to be the one who really perpetuates the tradition, but rather this guy, Ahiah.
This is the same story with Saul and...
Very good! Oh, wonderful!
Tearing his robe.
Excellent, excellent. No, brilliant, brilliant, brilliant. You are absolutely right. It's not the same, but it is definitely... there is definitely a... very good. A parallel illusion. See? Fantastic! Yeah, awesome. Remember when after Saul didn't kill the Agag, the Amalek king, Solomon, Shmuel turned away from him to go. Saul grabbed his cloak, tore it, and he said, "Just as you tore my cloak, so too God's going to tear your kingdom." Absolutely.
Same story.
Beautiful. Absolutely.
No, it's the reverse.
No, Saul went to grab Samuel.
No. In other words, the implication, the conclusion is the reverse.
Right, but you still have that idiom of like tearing a cloak and representing the division of the kingdom. Very good, Ed.
How could anybody have 700 wives? How is that possible?
Gotta eat a lot of Wheaties.
How is that possible? Well, I mean, said there were 700 wives and 300 concubines.
Right.
I don't know how that's
possible. Doesn't say he satisfied them all.
You could, I mean, when I would guess that, you know, at some point it was done for treaty purposes.
Okay.
It's an assumption, like why politically you would have such things. Practically, how does that work? No idea. I've never seen Big Love, but I could guess, you know, there are challenges there. Anyway, so I thank you for, you know, bringing that up, because it, you know, sort of hammers the point home of like why Ahiah would be here. But let's continue. Yoyada the priest received the tradition from Elisha in his court. Zechariah achieved the tradition from Yoyada in his court. Hoshea achieved the tradition from Zechariah. Amos from Hoshea. Isaiah achieved the tradition from Amos. Micha from Isaiah. Yoel from Micha. Nahum from Yoel. Habakkuk from Nahum. Nahum Zephaniah. Yirmiyahu from Zephaniah. Baruch ben Neriah from Yirmiyahu. Ezra from Baruch in his court. And the members of Ezra's court are referred to as Anshe Knesset Hagidullah, the men of the great assembly. They included Haggai, Zechariah, Malachi, Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, Azariah, Nehemiah ben Chakliah, Mordechai, the linguist transfers here, Mordechai, Bilshon, all right, Zerubbabel, and many other sages, 120 elders in all. The last surviving member of this group was Shimon the Just. He was included among the 120 elders and received the oral law from all of them. He served as the high priest of Ezra and Toganos of Soho, and his court received the tradition from Shimon the Just in his court. Now, you may recall some of the names mentioned here from... Exactly, the very beginning of Pirkei Avot. But instead of just saying the Nevi'im, right, Rambam's actually enumerating all of them. He's following the narrative of an unbroken chain of tradition from Har Sinai all the way down. Yeah.
Would you consider this axiom number 3?
No, I think I call this number 1 in terms of how Chazal defined themselves of, you know, following the, you know, following Pirkei Avot 1:1 is an unbroken chain of tradition that Rambam is now really expanding upon in great, great detail. All right? And now we get to, say, the rabbinic period, where you see that there's, you know, by having this, it's important to have an unbroken chain, because even though, you know, Chazal say, well, prophecy might have stopped at a certain point, that doesn't mean the chain of tradition had stopped. Right? So now we're going to move from the time of prophecy and prophet, like people who received divine inspiration directly from God, to more of what you would consider Chazal or the legal system. Continue, Ed. The last surviving member. Page 16, the last surviving member.
I think you read Shimon the Just in his court.
120 in all. No, I didn't get to Shimon the Just. Oh, right. So, sorry. Yossi ben Yoezer.
Yossi ben Yoezer of Tzreda and Yosef ben Yochanan of Jerusalem in their court received the tradition from Antigonus and his court.
Actually, you know what? Let me just go through all the continues first, and then we'll get you some meat here. Then you have Yeshua ben Parachia, Yosef ben Uezer.
Yeah, a whole bunch of Yosef guys.
Yes, well, pretty much. Yehuda ben Tavai, Shimon ben Shetach, Yeshua ben Parachia mentioned earlier from... received from Yeshua ben Parachia, Shmai Vavtalion, who were righteous converts, Hillel Shammai from Shmai and Avtalion, Yochanan ben Zakkai, and Rav Shimon from Hillel the Elder. The son of Hillel the Elder received the tradition from Hillel in Shammai in their courts. Rav Yochanan ben Zakkai had five students, Rav Elazar, the Shira, Rav Yossi the Kohen, Rav Shimon ben Netanel, Rav Elazar ben Arach, Rav Akiva ben Yosef, and a few other righteous converts here, which also show that, you know, for as much as people may disparage converts for not knowing, many were important parts of the chain of tradition. Mm-hmm. We can skip to, all right, the next next page where you have like page 18, in the middle of the page where it says Rabbeinu, Rabbi Yehuda, the son of Rabbi Shimon.
And referred to as Rabbeinu HaKodesh, our saintly teacher. They build these guys up.
Well, some people, you'll see why in a next paragraph, but continue.
Received a tradition from his father, from Rabbi Elazar ben Shammua, and from Rabban Shimon and his colleagues.
Okay.
Rabbeinu HaKodesh composed the Mishnah from the days of Moses, our teacher, until Rabbeinu HaKodesh. No one had composed the text for the purpose of teaching the oral law in public. Instead, in each generation, the head of the court or the prophet of that generation would take notes of the teaching which he received from his masters for himself and teach them verbally in public. Similarly, according to his own potential, each individual would write notes for himself of what he heard regarding the explanation of the Torah, its laws, and the new concepts that were deduced in each generation, concerning laws that were not communicated by the oral tradition, but rather deduced using one of the 13 principles of biblical exegesis and accepted by the high court.
Right. So here, what did Rav Yehuda HaNasi do, or Rabbeinu HaKodesh, as Rambam calls him, right?
Kadosh,
right? You did not have, a text for teaching your law in public, but rather you had notes and then you would teach them orally in public. And additionally, you had what was initially called, say, the oral law, like the certain things that were intrinsically transmitted, but you also had new things added. For example, in certain interpretations that were accepted as, authoritative, that might not have been passed down necessarily, but another court read things in a certain way. And because of that reading, that was determined to be law. Continue.
This situation continued until the age of Rabbeinu HaKodesh. He collected all the teachings, all the laws, and all the explanations and commentaries that were heard from Moses, our teacher, and which were taught by the courts in each generation concerning the entire Torah. From all these, he composed the text of the Mishnah. He taught it to the sages in public and revealed it to the Jewish people, who all wrote it down. They spread it in all places so that the oral law would not be forgotten by the Jewish people.
Right. All right, so we see that there was a certain need, right? Continue the next paragraph, and she'll explain the need for it.
Why did Rabbeinu HaKodesh make such an innovation instead of perpetuating the status quo? Because he saw the students becoming fewer, new difficulties constantly arising, the Roman Empire spreading itself throughout the world and becoming more powerful, and the Jewish people wandering and becoming dispersed to the far ends of the world. Therefore, he composed a single text that would be available to everyone so that it could be studied quickly and would not be forgotten. Throughout his entire life, he and his court taught the Mishnah to the masses.
And one thing that's meant, Rabbi, so the reason why it was necessary was, having an oral tradition is very useful if everything works out well, but once you start getting scattered, it's much harder to transmit things orally. In terms of the writing down part, Cheryl Lieberman writes that it wasn't you did have one text that was sort of locked away for reference purposes, but the codification that Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi did was primarily in formulation. Mishnayot are very terse. Often things are done or written in a certain way because they were easier to memorize than to disseminate publicly. You didn't have a publishing house, right? So how what Rabbi Yehuda Nasi really did was pick certain things and left out other things, or wrote things in such a way that you could just transmit the data much more easily, because you didn't really have a book. You might have written it down once as a copy that was locked away, but you would memorize the Mishnah, and you would transmit the Mishnah exactly as you heard it. And you would transmit the teachings exactly as you heard it. All right?
Do you consider this at all self-serving?
What do you mean?
In his mind, he's doing the same thing as Rabbeinu HaKadosh.
Well, we haven't gotten there yet, but it wouldn't necessarily be self-serving. And we'll explain at the end just how self-serving this is. But I should also point out that for the most part, nothing that Rambam has set up until this point wasn't already part of the rabbinic tradition. Right, so Rambam is effectively just now repeating, you could say the mythic history or narrative of the Talmud. Now, you can disagree with it. You could say maybe the Talmud did was self-serving. But we'll have to, again, finish the rest of the Rambam to see how does Rambam himself fit into this entire narrative. And we'll see that it's not as self-serving as it might indicate just from here, or at least where you might be going with it logically. Yeah.
Besides self-serving, there's descriptions of these guys that make them seem saintly. Rabbeinu HaKadosh. Guaranteed he's so holy. Or Moshe Rabbeinu, he's our teacher. I mean, what is all this stuff? It's propaganda.
Well, is it propaganda? Yes. Because you might trust them. Well, I mean, when you talk about propaganda, are you like building up these rabbis? Yes, because you find them valuable. Again, if you operate under the certain assumptions that say Torah is valuable, then Moshe Rabbeinu is, certainly as far as the Bible is concerned, a really prominent figure. Especially you read just how he's described at the end of Devarim. Pretty big deal there. In terms of Rabbeinu HaKadosh, assuming, again, following the narrative here, the dispersal was as bad as it was, Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi's innovation of writing down the Mishnah or compiling the Mishnah in any way effectively saved the oral law. Now, assuming you find the oral law to be of value, then someone who preserves the oral law, the main person responsible for preserving the oral law, is going to be treated a lot differently than a lot of other people.
It's like, when I refer to the president, I refer to Obama without saying president because I don't have that much respect for him. Mm-hmm. And people on his side say, President Obama, like, oh boy, this is a...
Or people in the middle who respect the office. Meaning there are people who might not like, how to put that? People may respect the office of the president, if not the individual who's there. Mm-hmm. Right? So people do it that way. But you're absolutely right.
Your Highness.
If you're absolutely right. If you don't respect the office or you don't respect the people, then yes, all of this is just, going to be meaningless. But when you're operating under a certain assumption with certain premises, then certain people are going to be treated with greater respect, and usually there's going to be a good reason for it. Again, with Moses, the Torah does that to Moses. Especially, refer you to read the last, few verses of, Deuteronomy, where, Moses is, touted more than anyone that I can think of in the Torah. Mm-hmm. And again, if someone, was really responsible for preserving the oral law, which again, you hold valuable, you're going to treat that person with a great deal of respect. To flip it another side, let's say you don't really care about science. Einstein was just another guy. What did he do? Right? Bill Gates didn't do anything. Right? Steve Jobs, he just stole everyone else's technology. It's if you work for Apple, though, Steve Jobs is the man. If you work for Microsoft, Bill Gates is the man. Mm. From the other side, each one just stole from someone else and just made a lot of money off of other people's works. Right? Bill Gates didn't design DOS. He just bought it from someone else, like, really cheaply and did some marketing stuff. Yeah, you're right. I can't really argue that, but you could certainly understand why someone in Rambam's position would treat people with this sort of respect, because he does have that degree of respect for the Torah and for the Torah Shebaal Peh and sees the innate value there. Mm-hmm. All right? Shlomo, take the next paragraph from These Are the Great Sages.
These are the great sages who were part of the court of Rabbeinu HaKadosh and who received the tradition from him. His sons, Shimon and Gamliel, Rabbi Ephes, Rabbi Hanina ben Hama, Rabbi Chia, Rabbi Yanai, Bar Kalka, Shmuel, Rabbi Yochanan, Rabbi Hoshea, thousands and myriads of other sages received the tradition from Rabbeinu HaKadosh together with these great sages. Even though all of the 11 sages mentioned above received the tradition from Rabbeinu HaKadosh and attended his study sessions, there are differences between them. At that time, Rabbi Yochanan was of lesser stature. Afterwards, he became a disciple of Rabbi Yonai and received the instruction from him. Similarly, Rav received the tradition from Rabbi Yonai, and Shmuel received the tradition from Rabbi Hanina ben Kama.
Right, so you've got here, you know, a lot of rabbis might have studied, you know, in the same court of Rabbeinu HaKadosh at the same time, but some students were, and let's say, more advanced than others. You know, you could either say in terms of intellectual acumen, or it could even just be age. Right, of maturity, or just they all studied together, but some were considered, you know, superior to others. All right, continue.
Rav composed the Sifra and the Sifra to explain the sources for the Mishnah. Rav Achia composed the Tosefta to explain the subjects discussed in the Mishnah. Rabbi Hoshea and Bar Kafra composed Bar Baraito to explain the matters discussed in the Mishnah. Rabbi Yochanan composed the Jerusalem Talmud in Eretz Yisrael approximately 300 years after the destruction of the temple.
All right, so we have a lot, right? So after the Mishnah, you have, Rambam here seems to put all of, you know, the things as somewhat contemporaries. You have the Sifra and the Sifrei to explain the sources for the Mishnah. And these are, you know, what we have today are mostly Midrashei Halakha, where they are legal expositions of biblical verses, where there's a certain interpretation of a biblical verse that has a legal consequence. You have a Tosefta, which is printed today in the back of our Gemaras, and a separate Braitot of other matters discussed. Rav Yochanan was attributed to have written the Jerusalem Talmud, which would be more expositions on the Mishnah itself.
Are any of these attributions accepted by contemporary scholars?
Probably not. The Tosefta, there's a huge fight over that in terms of where was the Tosefta written. There was one person who even tried saying that the Tosefta that we have was compiled after the Bavli. And that's another important point to consider. There's who wrote the original book, and who wrote the book that we have in its current form? Because the two might not be identical.
And is he making this up, or does he have sources?
I'm not sure. I think with Rav Chia it is mentioned in some other context. I mentioned here in the footnote here, the commentaries have not found explicit source supporting the Rambam's contention that Rabbi Yochanan composed the Jerusalem Talmud. Indeed, it appears the final text of the work was composed by Rav Man and Rav Yossi ben Rabbi Bun approximately 100 years after Rav Yochanan's death. Some commentaries explained that Rabbi Yochanan laid the foundation for the text that was completed by the later sages. So there you go.
Among the great sages who received the tradition from Rav and Shmuel were Rav Huna, Rav Yehuda, Rav Nachman, and Rav Kahana. Among the great sages who received the tradition from Rabbi Yochanan were Rav Bar Chana, Rav Ami, Rav Asi, Rav Dimi, and Rav Avi.
All right, and he goes through a whole bunch more here, and then it's almost like Pesach. When you go through you sing Dayenu, and then you sort of like do a recap of Dayenu, you know, he mentions some more sages, and he says that there were 40 generations from Rav Ashi, back to Moshe, it ends off with here, among the sages who received the tradition from Rav were Rav Ashi and Ravina. Marbar, Rav Ashi received the tradition from Rav Ashi and his father, from his father and from Ravina. Although there were actually two Ravinas in the Gemara, but that's a whole separate discussion. Thus, there were 40 generations from Rav Ashi back to Moses, our teacher of blessed memory, and he lists them all. That's his name, Tzashu Kolam Yashem Elokei Israel. Thus, the source of all these people's knowledge is God, the source of Israel. And we'll stop here because, you know, the rest will get us to the other things. But it seems that if you want to talk about the narrative for rabbinic authority, Rambam is throwing all of his weight behind the unbroken chain of tradition. Now, you can say, I mean, the truth is there's more to it too, which he describes in the actual Mishnah Torah when he goes through like certain halachot. But if I'm going to write a book for the masses, I know, spoiler alert, that's what he says he's doing, what's going to be most convincing to the people, certainly the people of his era? You can say, well, you know, why should I listen to you? By tracing back the chain of tradition, Rambam is effectively saying, yes, all of the people up until a certain point were part of one unbroken chain of tradition. Right? In which case, if you're just lazy, like, okay, that makes sense. Well, what is this chain of tradition? So Rambam lays it out for you. Here's how the chain of tradition worked. So is it going to be convincing to a lot of people today? No. Was it convincing to people back then? Maybe, maybe not. If you're already predisposed to not believing in Judaism, this wasn't going to convince you. But if you needed, say, reassurance of, like, is what I'm doing matter? Certainly this helps. Because it shows that rabbis weren't just making stuff up on their own, that there was at least some system that they were following. Right? And when you can show an unbroken chain of tradition, and he ends off by saying, you know, when he gives the list of Dayenu, it's important that he works backwards. Right? He starts off with what we have here as number one, as Rav Ashi from, or received the tradition from Rava, and then he's working backwards through time, up until that last line of 40, Moshe Rabbeinu Mipi Agvura. Right? So he goes from the top down, and then he goes from the bottom back up. Again, hammering that point home, that all of this Torah ultimately is from God. That it's not just, you know, rabbis doing their own thing.
The longer the list is, the more possibility that there was some corruption in the transmission.
Mm. He's going to discuss that later. Mm. We actually saw some of that in the Gemara itself. The Akedot, where there was, after Moses' death, there were laws that were forgotten. You've got in the Gemara itself, people argue about what does a Mishnah say. Right, and that lines itself as, oh, this is what he said, or this is what he really meant, because the Mishnah again was designed to be memorized. It wasn't designed to be comprehensive. You don't have it both ways, which means stuff is going to be left out of Mishnayot, or you may have like an inaccurate or imprecise choice of words in the Mishnah that's then rediscovered or uncovered logically by the Gemara. That mm-hmm. happens really often, you know, or Hachi Garcia, like this is how we read the Mishnah. Right, but you still need the Mishnah in its current form because that's how you need to memorize it. Right, you know that's let's say acronyms. Right, acronyms are just headings. Right, they don't tell you anything unless you know everything. But you have to sit and you have to expound it. But it's a lot easier to remember the acronym, and because of the acronym, you remember everything else that it represents.
One question comes to mind. I want to remember to ask you this before we leave. I asked the rabbi this a long time ago. What's your opinion about the status of other religions?
What is the status of other religions? In what sense?
Do you give them respect, or do you consider them distortions of reality?
Ah, well, I'll tell you this. I'll answer this just off tape. In the meantime,
got you against the rope.
In the meantime, this Wednesday's class on current Jewish questions, we're going to be discussing gun control in light of the massacre in Sandy Hook Elementary School in Newport, Connecticut. So that'll be this Wednesday at 8 p.m. And next week here, we'll continue, maybe finish off the Rambam.